as we have to finish at half past six exactly, I'm going to move on now immediately to the next session, which is entitled Reporting the Region, the Broader Perspectives. And the panel on this occasion on my right, Professor Michael Burley, who's a journalist, author and historian, and research professor at the University of Buckingham. My immediate left, Farouk Sousa, who is the chief economist of the Middle East for the City Global Markets, and Jonathan Rudman, far left, who is the foreign affairs correspondent for Channel 4 News. So again, I'm going to adopt the same procedure, 10 minutes each, and at the end of that, I will open it to the floor for questions until half past six.
I'd just like to reassure any anxious Iranians that as a neighbour of Jack Straw, he can't actually operate his own burglar alarm, let alone run an agent network. Be that as it may, most of us know that discussions of the Middle East are influenced by hordes of paid lobbyists and PR persons. Their handiwork includes the lavish newspaper advertorials about clinics, universities and petrochemical plants that make good compost or firelighters. Newspapers are segments of larger groups with ramified interests in such areas as construction and commercial property development. They have major foreign shareholders too, none of them, of course, under present circumstances, Iranians, though since 2007 the Iranian Revolutionary Guard has had its Anglophone free-to-air press TV station. I just want to start by focusing on something I'll call enthusiasm. I don't mean enthusiasts for falconry, modern railways, or toy soldiers, but something akin to the religious fervour of 17th century Puritans. This is why temperate Anglicans alighted on the term, as they invited Puritan enthusiasts to decamp to the howling wilderness of New England. Unfortunately, the modern world lacks somewhere comparable for Al-Qaeda and ISIS, though Richard Branson's wretched rockets and the moon come to mind. This brings us directly to the subject in hand. There is much enthusiasm in reporting of Iran and Saudi Arabia as the nuclear deal with Tehran opens up new commercial and diplomatic vistas. Let's explore the business pages with which I'm most familiar. A future Iranian investment bonanza is talked up, often beyond the gritty political realities of oil and natural gas contracts, or the rival claims to post-sanctions windfall money of the IRGC and the oil ministry. This in turn impacts on Iran's future domestic direction of travel as we nervously calculate who's up or down in Tehran. Meanwhile, investment bankers, and I know some of them, rub their hands over a Saudi Aramco IPO allegedly worth $5 to $10 trillion, without thinking about how that might consort with the kingdom's subsidised social welfare model and massive public sector, not to mention more opaque uses of the revenues. Again, is such a rapid transition feasible, judging from how many problems China, for example, is experiencing in making its own much larger move from capex to consumerism? These glimmering investment opportunities also, of course, become part of a larger strategic clash with the $100 billion Iranian opportunity trumped by the $344 billion Saudi Arabian counteroffer of the money that it wishes to attract, as the Wall Street Journal reported on Tuesday. Now, to move away from mere money, enthusiasm is also evident in how these respective political cultures and societies are more widely discussed or reported, for the two activities are not the same. Iran, we are told, is a venerable civilization with a parliament dating back to 1906, where women have had the vote since 1963, which derives more revenue nowadays from income taxes than from oil and gas rents, and whose science graduates, of which there are many, can do more advanced stem cell research than is possible in the United States. All true, of course. But it also has a dual governance structure that distorts elections, as we shall no doubt see by Saturday, a powerful deep state, and ambitions that reflect the Islamic Republic's version of Persian manifest destiny. Iran's support for terrorism may have been dialed down during the Geneva nuclear talks, which artfully sidestepped that issue, But over the deal's 15 years lifespan, it can be dialed up again, especially as Hezbollah now enjoys what you might call aerial roof from Moscow and Beijing's support for killing Chinese terrorists in Syria. And then we come to Saudi Arabia. Public enthusiasm for the kingdom in this country is a rarefied affair and largely connected with BAE jobs in Lancashire, though we know, of course, that its deferential society has its elite apologists in the so-called Camel Corps, the military and St James's Palace. Whether this results in what a witty Guardian journalist recently called a bog-off relationship with the kingdom, a supermarket term implying buy our arms and get our foreign policy free, others here are much more qualified to determine. Saudi Arabia's claims to be in the vanguard of fighting Islamist terrorism ring hollow to many Western commentators, and I'm talking about them rather than myself, given that worldwide propagation of Wahhabism has provided the mulch of sectarian intolerance from which terrorism has grown from Nigeria to Pakistan, as indeed the Wall Street Journal reported at great length a few weeks ago. Perhaps the local equivalent of the biblical Romans 13, that's the bit, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's for non-Christians, gets lost in translation once it's left Riyadh. Though we also know, and I've no reason to disbelieve it, that the General Intelligence Directorate and Interior Ministry run a tight ship. There are also more local intolerances which have been reported widely in our newspapers. As Richard Dearlove said in July 2014, tropes familiar from the typology of European anti-Semitism are reversed engineered against the large Shia minority in Saudi Arabia's eastern province, heretical, rejectionist, cat's paws of a mischievous Iran being the gist of it. This, of course, is not to deny that the 3 million Arab Awazi in southern Iran have a tough time, but since they're overwhelmingly Shia, the intensities of discrimination differ. Reporting of Tehran's regional machinations, and here I would agree with Graham Lamb, seems to have been eclipsed by the smiling faces of Rouhani and Zarif, but widespread concern has also been expressed in our press, both here and the United States, about the new forward-thrusting technocratic team in Riyadh. Our allies and friends in the German Bundesnachrichtendienst, the BND, made this very point in a memo they released to the press last December, though it was rapidly recanted by the German Foreign Ministry. Press commentary on Saudi intervention in Yemen has been progressively negative, largely because of collateral casualties caused by the air war. And there's also increasingly negative coverage of the conservative Islamist Jaish al-Fatah alliance that Riyadh is sponsoring in Syria's civil war, who would not match what most of us would define as moderate. More broadly, what do the press make of Riyadh's new self-assertions? These include grand 34 Muslim nation counter-terror alliances, which seem to come and go, and some of the members don't realise they've joined it. Ground forces that are offered to fight ISIS in a two-front war parallel to the one in Yemen. Man-pad missiles and the like are promised to neutralise the Syrian and Russian air forces, as the foreign minister recently said. Well, good luck with that one, as President Putin lowers the doctrinal terms for using tactical nuclear weapons. Most of what I've reported, and I stress reported, comes from mainstream and often highly conservative American newspapers and magazines, as well as our own equivalents. Blaming poor Obama for the great retreat and the pivoting to Asia-Pacific, if that is what it is, underestimates shifts in American opinion, which has not forgotten who the 9/11 murderers were or how Al-Qaeda was funded. Some explicitly call, and again I'm talking about commentators, for a reversal of US regional alliances on the grounds that Iranian society more closely resembles Western modernity, which I suppose it does if you ignore Evin Prison and the more apocalyptic depths of Shia 12ism, to focus on pretty girls with pushback headscarves daringly driving fast cars. Of course, the influence of chatterers and scribblers, such as ourselves, should not be overrated, though the Saudis might want to take a look at what the uninvolved public routinely writes beneath our articles. Were Western powers to climb onto the same fence occupied by, for example, China, Russia or Pakistan, all of which do big business with both sides, must be very worrying to Riyadh, especially since such a move would be popular, given how this interminable conflict is straining public patience. Now, paradoxically, a minority of media opinion also says, perhaps wisely, that we should keep the Saudis close, because not just because of their oil wealth, but their clout in what is essentially an imploding Sunni Arab world, whose human consequences we're reaping in the Aegean and Mediterranean. We might also assume that the main Sunni power might have some leverage over those who would actively do our own great civilization physical harm. I'll conclude by saying that while all the reporters' journeys and individual stories of grief that greedily compete for our attention are still capable of generating an emotional response, the analytical mood towards this conflict is one of clear-eyed lack of enthusiasm that will require more than lobbyists, PR persons, let alone advertorials, to overcome. Thank you very much.
Michael, thank you for inviting another chatterer and scribbler, as Michael Burley put it. As a journalist bound by Ofcom regulation and a firm believer in the impartiality of what I do, it is very nice occasionally to be able to say what I think. And I will take that opportunity now, if I may. The title, Reporting the Region, I think the very fact that I'm here and not in Saudi Arabia or Iran points to how very difficult that is. It's extremely difficult to get a visa for either country. The fact that we are Saudi's so-called ally in the war against terror and have been for a long time doesn't seem to make much difference with Iran, which of course has been on a sanctions list for a very long time as far as journalists are concerned. My letter to the Saudi embassy requesting a visa must have got lost in the post. And there are journalists covering the elections in Iran this week who have only gone there, not because they're particularly interested in the result, but because they fear they won't get a visa the next time they apply if they don't turn up. Mind you, whole careers are made by people who have visited neither Iran nor Saudi Arabia, so perhaps I shouldn't worry too much. I did, however, get to spend some time with Adel Al-Jubeer, the Saudi foreign minister, in the Saudi embassy last month. And on the mantelpiece of the room where we met, there were what looked like brandy flasks, which I got rather excited about, not least because I was a little thirsty, but also because I wondered what brandy was doing in the Saudi embassy. When I approached, I realized that the brandy flasks, in fact, contained different types of oil, with little metal signs on the outside telling me what they were. Mr. Adel Al-Jubeer is a young and forthright foreign minister. He says what he thinks. He told me I should respect the right of Saudi Arabia to execute people, 47 on a single day last month. He said it was an internal matter and that Saudi did not interfere with the internal judicial matters of the UK. He said Sheikh Al-Nimr, who was executed, was a terrorist as bad as Osama bin Laden. And he said that his nephew, who was also on death row and who was famously championed by Jeremy Corbyn in his first speech at the Labour Party conference as leader, that this nephew had had a weapon and had used violence. He also told me he would investigate so-called collateral damage caused by coalition airstrikes in Yemen. And in an echo of the late King Abdullah's advice to the Americans that they should cut the head off the Iranian snake, he talked about Iran more than he did about anything else. He pointed out that Iran executes far more people than Saudi Arabia does. And that although critics keep pointing out that 15 of the 19 9/11 hijackers were Saudis, it was Iran that was on the list of countries of state-sponsored terrorism. He also made a point that Saudis often make, which is that two-thirds of women graduates in Saudi Arabia are women. But it's clear that Syria, the main battleground for power and influence between these two countries, is heading for a division between Sunni and Alawite extremes. Those divisions stretch further than you might think. We're not just talking about Lebanon and the recent cut of Saudi military aid to the Lebanese government. We're talking about Iraq, Bahrain, even Mauritius, Djibouti, Comoros, Somalia and Sudan. The Saudis are worried about Iranian influence in all those countries. It's interesting that the Saudis are clearly losing the PR war when it comes to comparisons with the Iranians in the British press. That is partly a consequence of a change of leadership in the last year, a country finding its feet again, and as other speakers have said, exerting a far more visible foreign policy. I think the Saudis have enjoyed doing things quietly for a very long time, but bombing Yemen is not a quiet thing to do, nor is executing 47 people in a single day. Though they are employing PR agencies and reputation management companies, some of them based here, to try and improve their image. As the Saudi foreign minister put it to me, Iran has to decide if it is a revolution or a nation state. That is at the heart of the grievance, I think, that the Saudis feel. I noticed that the head of the Revolutionary Guard openly appeared at the funeral of an Iranian commander killed in the fight for Aleppo recently. Now, I'm not sure we should be really shocked by that brazen appearance, because, of course, so many of us are fighting proxy wars in Syria. I fear the Iranians and the Russians are better at it than we are, and that there is something far more existential at stake for both those countries in Syria than there is for the rest of us. And that existential nature of the fight means that they are more likely to achieve some kind of victory than we are, however pyrrhic that victory will be. And I'm sure it will be pyrrhic. The Saudis are, of course, largely funding the CIA operation to train Syrian rebels, an operation hamstrung by the increasing sophistication of Russian tanks and the refusal of the Americans to supply anti-aircraft weapons to shoot those Russian jets down. I can well understand why one would not give people one doesn't know particularly well anti-aircraft missiles for use against passenger jets at a later date. But I think until the Russians suffer a significant reverse in Syria, they will see no reason to stop what they're doing. I'm tempted to ask Graham to organise the sabotage of the Sukhoi jets currently parked at an airbase in Latakia, with nobody quite knowing who carried that sabotage out. I recently was on the Turkish-Syrian border a week or two ago, and what is most striking about what we've been talking about today, the geopolitical battle between Iran and Saudi Arabia, is how nebulous and invisible it is to reporters such as myself. It's only when you talk to victims of Russian airstrikes who are being treated in Turkish hospitals that you get a sense of what is going on, and even the exodus of refugees feels like a byproduct of something that is quite hard for us to see, and certainly television journalists to report. I once asked a senior British intelligence official if it was time to recalibrate the relationship with Saudi Arabia in light of the changing relationship with Iran, and he said to me quite rightly, "You're getting ahead of yourself, Jonathan." And indeed I was. I want to end. I'm Yemen, but I'm sort of running out of time. I fear it's going to turn out to be a rather cynical and shoddy episode in British foreign policy history. As many of you know, UK export licences between July and September last year for bombs and missiles topped £1 billion. We are all well aware of the importance of BAE systems to our economy and our jobs, but one can't disassociate the profits announced by BAE this month of £1.5 billion from the sale of Typhoon jets to Saudi. And nor be unaware of the United Nations reckoning that some 3,000 of the 6,000 people killed in Yemen in the last year or so have been civilians, with the majority killed by airstrikes killed by the Saudi-led coalition. I will end with a comparison that is quite interesting between a historical analogy between Saudi Arabia now and Iran in the 1970s. Because we should bear in mind that the UK's support for the Shah accounted for 30% of UK defence exports in the 1970s. We sold them 770 Chieftain tanks, and a second order of 1,450 Chieftains was stopped by the revolution itself. Clearly there was a recalibration after that revolution, and in a sense the Saudis and our relationship with the Saudis has been the beneficiary of that. Iran also ordered two Concords when nobody else wanted them, and the standard Iranian saloon car was built from a kit which was manufactured in the UK prior to the revolution. The enmity between the two countries is of course rooted in Ayatollah Khomeini himself. When Ayatollah Khamenei opened Ayatollah Khomeini's will, in the first paragraph there was a denunciation of the Saudi royal family. In the 1940s, Khomeini referred to the camel grazers of Riyadh as sort of Arabist bling, people who had, of course, brought the word of the book, the Arabs that is, to the Iranians, to the Persians, with the added shame of it being delivered in Arabic, which is something worth thinking about when you consider the Arab conquests of the 7th century. I think there will be a recalibration of our relationship with Iran. I think it's going to take an enormously long time, given that we're, 35 years on from the revolution, and that the talks in which Jack Straw was so instrumental have only recently concluded. But I think it's going to be enormously difficult, because I think the cultural and economic, the cultural differences between the two and the economic reliance we now have on Saudi Arabia is going to make that change of tactic and that change of strategy and that attempt to be the bridge between the two countries enormously difficult to achieve. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Good evening. And I'd like to thank the Global Strategy Forum for what has hitherto been an extremely fascinating discussion. And I do apologize in advance if hitherto is the key word there, because I am an economist. I work for an investment bank. And really, I have quite little to add to the debate in terms of the geopolitics. And feel it's my duty, really, to talk about the economics a little bit, because I think they are relevant. Jack Straw actually started out his discussion with talk about GDP per capita, warmed my heart. I thought, excellent. I think that really highlights how Saudi-Iranian rivalry, while of course is in part, large part sectarian, in large part about power politics, I think more about power politics, we all agree, than it is about sectarianism, it's also about economic rivalry. And prior to 1979, the rivalry was very clearly between who was going to be the darling oil king, effectively, global oil king. Saudi Arabia won that following the 79 revolution, and Saudi Arabia is now in a position of relinquishing its title. And I think that is a very, very significant driver of the fear of the ascendance of Iran going forward, that economic threat that an ascending Iran represents to Saudi interests. And I think that's key. The way that's manifested clearly, mainly, in my view, is in the oil markets, in the global oil markets. Iran is currently producing somewhere like 2.5 million barrels a day less oil than it was 5 years ago. And that's entirely down to the sanctions, the drying up of investment, and the drying up of export opportunities that the sanctions necessitated. Now that the sanctions have been lifted, Iran is looking to ramp up oil again. And clearly, in an oil market which is already flooded with cheap oil, this is a major threat to the outlook for global oil prices and, therefore, for Saudi Arabia. It's about market share, it's about oil prices, and it's about dominance. I think the efforts over the past couple of weeks, oil traders have had a little bit of good news in the sense that the Saudis and the Russians have come together with a few other countries to talk about an oil freeze, saying that they're going to freeze oil at current production levels. Slightly disingenuous when they're trying to include the Iranians at their much lower current oil production levels. I think the Iranians quite rightly have said, it's a great idea, but we're not buying it. Without Iran freezing oil production, let's not even talk about oil cuts, which is actually what the market really needs to see in order to see oil prices come back up. But without Iran freezing oil production, and also Iraq, for that matter, at current levels, this deal doesn't make any sense at all. And there's no way that Iran is going to freeze its oil production at current levels. It would be playing into the hands of quite, I think, a cynical economic foreign policy that is being concocted by the Saudis. So I don't think that that's going to happen. And therefore, what we are looking at over the course of the coming years is a beggar-thy-neighbor rivalry in global oil markets, where Iran is going to try its hardest to ramp up oil production. This is going to lead to continued softness in the oil markets, and this is going to lead to a continued decline in revenues for the Saudi government, which is where I'm coming to in my second point. The Saudis and the Iranians, if they're locked into a beggar-thy-neighbor policy war, who's best placed to withstand that? Now, Jack Straw did talk about how rich the Saudis were relative to the Iranians. But a loss of income hurts rich people much more than it hurts poor people. And the Saudis are a lot less resilient in many respects to hard economic circumstances and conditions than the Iranians are. If we look at it from a fiscal perspective, we look at public finances, the Iranians, it was mentioned, somebody mentioned earlier on the panel, that the majority of Iranian income comes from taxes and income taxes, corporate taxes and so on. Virtually none in Saudi Arabia comes, a very small amount of income tax and corporate tax fills the coffers of the Saudi government. 90% of oil 90% of revenues in Saudi Arabia come from oil, whereas only about 30-35% of revenues in Iran come from oil. So if we're looking at the fiscal impact of lower oil prices, it's quite clear that Saudi Arabia has a lot more to lose than Iran does. Moreover, in a world where lower oil prices are coming because the Iranians are actually increasing production, well, you do the maths, clearly higher production levels, even at a lower oil price, means those revenues are going up for Iran at a time when those revenues continue to decline for Saudi Arabia. But even beyond oil and beyond the fiscal outlook, we can look at these two economies and say, well, what is the impact on the wider economy going to be of these kind of more difficult economic conditions? Iran has lived since 1979 under extreme stress from a series of, well, clearly during the 1980s, a very, very vicious war, and then very, very strict sanction regimes that have been more or less constant for the past 30 years, where that has led to an economy that is much more resilient to adversity, an economy where the locals have developed a certain capacity to survive. They produce a lot of stuff domestically. They have a vibrant domestic manufacturing base, whereas the Saudis produce virtually nothing at home. They have no manufacturing base. Anything that is produced in Saudi Arabia has a huge amount of import added value to it. And so when we're looking at a situation where these two economies come under stress, I would argue, quite comfortably, that the Iranians have already experienced the stress and are in a better position to absorb further stress going forward. So a beggar-thy-neighbor policy is not, in my view, in the best interest of the Saudi Arabians, but may well be in the best interest of the Iranians going forward. And I think that is going to be inform this rivalry, how this rivalry plays out over the coming few years. I think just, because I'm conscious of time, I just want to talk a little bit about the regional dimension from an economic perspective as well. We talked about the Lebanon. We didn't mention Iraq that much, but I want to touch on Iraq because I think it's important. Saudi Arabia is going into this period of stress. Public finances are under considerable pressure, obviously. The economy is going to feel the ramifications. Saudi Arabia is not going to be as rich going forward as it has been over the past decade. That's just a matter of fact. It's very, very important to recognize how important Saudi's economic ascendance over the past 10 years has been in supporting the non-oil economies of the region as well. The likes of Lebanon, Jordan, Egypt. These are all highly dependent on Saudi Arabia, Pakistan as well, highly dependent on Saudi Arabia in a number of areas. One is direct handouts. I mean, the Egyptian government, I'm from Egypt, the Egyptian government could not have survived over the past 3 or 4 years, purely from an economic perspective. There would have been a massive bounce of payments crisis had it not been for Saudi money coming in and propping up that Sisi's government. Direct handouts have also been evident to Jordan with lots of grants from Saudi Arabia and also to Lebanon. Until last week, they had a big deal of $3 billion in arms. These are very, very clearly important government-to-government forms of support that are starting to be less tenable for the Saudi government to continue providing because the Saudi government itself is under fiscal pressure. So that is a key issue. And so as Saudi influence diminishes with these governments, then you have to question whether or not its rivalry is also sustainable. There's also clearly indirect ways in which Saudi Arabia helps the rest of the region. If we look at remittances, for example, remittances on average are something like 20% of GDP. They represent something like 20% of GDP for countries like Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, and Pakistan, not to mention the Philippines and India and others. That's a huge amount of inflows from workers, Egyptians, Jordanians, Lebanese workers living and working in the Gulf countries, but largely in Saudi Arabia. They send this money home. That money supports domestic consumption. Your aunt, your uncle, your grandmother, all these people use that money to buy things in, domestically. That's a huge, huge economic support that is in peril. Because as the Saudis go into economic malaise, jobs are on the line. The first jobs that are going to go are going to be the foreigners. They're not going to be sacking Saudis in Saudi Arabia, they'll be sacking those foreigners. And there's a program, the Nitikad program, the Saudization program, in place that is explicitly and has been for, well, it's been in place for now 23 years, but over the past 3 years it's been ramped up, that is specifically trying to switch out of dependence on foreign labor and promote local employment. And as that program takes hold, and I think it's a priority for the Saudis to push forward with this program, it makes a lot of sense, this program, I'm not criticizing it. I think it's an important program because employment is a key issue, a political issue for the Saudis going forward. As this program takes hold and continues, in an environment where the overall economy is shrinking, you're going to see more and more Egyptians and Jordanians in particular, but also potentially Lebanese and others going home. And that means those remittances are going to fall. That means greater FX stress in the wider Middle East region. It means lower consumption. It means greater economic hardship in the region as a whole. So I do think that is something to look at. That, of course, in addition to Saudi's explicit support and rivalry and deepening sectarianism in key countries such as Lebanon, such as Iraq, which obviously has an adverse effect on those economies as well, I think there is a lot there to think about in terms of how this rivalry is, A, motivated by economics, but is also going to have a massive impact on the economics of the region as well. I'll stop there.
Very interesting perspective. The reason I was looking out was the person I was going to call from the last session has actually left, so I just wanted to make sure. I hope we can get some interesting additions to those perspectives as well as questions. First person I'm going to call is Dr.
Hamilton.
How's it going?
We were told when the nuclear deal was signed to Iran, there's going to be a flood of investment into Iran. I gather one of the biggest problems in the short term is because sanctions haven't been lifted by the United States, so no British bank will actually lend you any money, which is quite a deterrent. And then we discover that Iran has an extremely high rate of corruption, and that a large number of its best industries are owned by the Iranian Republican Guard. So the whole thing seems to me to be rather like Putin's Russia, where you could invest in it, but you might well lose all your money.
I think, as an economist working for an investment bank, I've been out to the region on numerous occasions advising clients, corporate clients, about opportunities in Iran. And we've all been guilty of this kind of kind of over-optimism regarding the investment climate in Iran. But I wouldn't describe it as Putin's Russia. I would describe it probably as the Eastern Bloc following the fall of the wall. So it's very much like trying to invest in the Eastern Bloc in the early 1990s. The reason is that there are massive corruption is an issue, of course, but there are also massive vested interests, people who have done very well out of sanctions, who have been, who have built themselves very nice little monopolies and oligopolies within the economy. The IOGC is obviously a key actor in that respect. And so there are vested interests, and those vested interests are going to be extremely difficult to break down. There are also constitutional reasons. Following the 79 revolution, there was an overhaul of the economy, and a huge part of Iranian industry was brought under the auspices of the government, and there are very strict restrictions with respect to who can or cannot invest. I mean, Saudi Arabia has blacklists, but you know the Iranians have blacklists on steroids. I mean, there's very little that you can actually go in and invest in. And their oil contracts are very complicated because of issues running sovereignty and national resources. So it is extremely difficult. And I think that we have to be realistic about it. But we also have to be very low based. And so any investment going into Iran is going to be very significant. But Iran, beyond investment, still is a massive market. So it's not just about investment, it's also about trade. And I think that a huge amount of trade is going to be taking place with Iran. I think going forward, that trade is going to be mutually beneficial. I mean, the Iranian delegation, for example, that came through Italy and France over the past week, signing billions in contracts with Airbus and others, that's going to be a key opportunity for Western business, but also it's going to be extremely economically empowering to the Iranians. And so I think while Iran is a difficult place to invest, economically, things are looking relatively up for Iran, whereas in Saudi Arabia,
can I just add 3 points to your question? One is that the United States hasn't been particularly helpful by cancelling visa waiver programs for any businessmen who go to Iran. Secondly, because of the sanctions busting or target state of the last few years or more, the IRGC owns huge, controls huge swathes of the Iranian economy, so you could be quite legitimately negotiating with what you thought was a businessman, but who turns out to be a representative or a tool of some organisation which, say, is involved in ballistic missile programmes, let alone terrorism, and then you would find yourself in a world of trouble with the United States Treasury Department, which I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. So on all those levels, I would think it's a very tricky business. And then lastly, something we actually haven't talked about, because it's a sort of lawyer's thing, really, and I'm not a lawyer, is that the Iranian parliament, of course, has quite a big influence on the framing of contracts, particularly in the oil and natural gas sector, and they will be haggling about this, sans pareil, one's tempted to say. And so you don't really know what the legal status situation is. You don't know about the courts, who's going to arbitrate any difficulties. I mean, I think having seen these enormous commercial vistas open up, they're shrinking by the day when you look at the detail.
I don't know how many times I've been. Anybody else got a question?
which did not bark. It's like Donald Anderson, cousin was. The dog which did not bark. That some little while ago, most Arab states, and I guess a group like this, would be pointing the finger at Israel as the troublemaker in all the region. And all the ills in some ways attributable to Israel. But if we look now around the region, not just Turkey, Saudi Arabia and Iran, a little further afield in the current troubles in Algeria, Egypt, that this is probably the answer to those who simply see all in the region as an Israeli conspiracy. So what are the links between the two major countries we've discussed with Israel? Is there some much under the radar, much under the screen, which somehow does give some relationship, which we perhaps don't know of, but what are the current links, if any?
Well, Jack referred earlier to the relationship between the Israelis and the Iranians in the 1980s. I think the relationship between Iran and Israel, I think it's worth pointing out that the major fear of Western intelligence agencies in the run-up to the 2012 Olympics in London was that an Iranian sleeper cell would respond to Israeli airstrikes in Iran and would respond right here. So in terms of the relationship between Israel and Iran, it did reach a very, very serious point, as we know. The relationship between Saudi Arabia and Israel is a good one. And I think they have a lot in common that they wouldn't necessarily wish to talk about, but that relationship is certainly there. I think the point was made by Michael that it's very difficult to talk about de-escalation in the Middle East when you don't include Israel and you can't include Israel. And I think that will continue to be the case, although, I mean, so many of us have noticed that the Palestinian issue has moved off the headlines. There's despair on all sides, a sense that the two-state solution is dead in all but name. Now, I've no doubt that will come back in some shape or form, and that what I sometimes refer to as the stabbing intifada, which is these strange incidents of violence which have occurred, killing more Palestinians than Israelis, because the Israelis then shoot the perpetrators. So that will continue to bubble away and continue to fester, but do I think that Iran and Saudi Arabia really care about a solution to the Palestinian issue? No, I don't.
I'd just make a few random observations about Israel and all of this. First of all, that Israeli analysis of Iran comes in two sort of broad camps. Well, one is very big and the other one is very small, put it that way. The big camp is that they take Shia theology extremely seriously, and are, you know, particularly obviously under Ahmadinejad, and then they just see Rouhani as the smiling face of the same phenomenon. So it's a very almost old-fashioned history of ideas approach, as I would see it as a former academic, towards that phenomenon. The much smaller camp, and I heard this from a man called Larbi, who was actually Israel's last ambassador to Tehran and the Shah, who is quite convinced, perhaps rather naively, that the nuclear deal will lead on to, will precipitate reforms in Iran of a liberalizing nature, and that the regime actually won't be able to stop it. But that is, I stress, a really minor view. I suppose also, while we're on the subject, Israel is quite relieved that, as you said, some of the 20-odd conflicts going on in the Middle East that don't involve Israel are occupying people's attention nowadays. They really don't have anything to do with them. In a changing world, they also are quietly altering their diplomatic stance. After all, with a million Russian speakers, including the foreign minister, who was a Moldovan Russian speaker, Israel has not said a peep about Russia's illegal occupation of Crimea and eastern Ukraine. It's very carefully hedged its bets. Then Netanyahu, like many other leaders in that region, has rushed to Moscow along with the Saudi kings, the Jordanians, etc., etc., to pay court to the new tough guy on the block, the activist tough guy on the block. And that activist tough guy has actually ridden the coach and horses in a way through the West's strategic alliances in the Middle East, because he's partly got them all now looking to him, because after all, he is loyal to his friends, as they would see him acting in propping up Assad. And then, of course, he really wins on another level, which is not often talked about in this context, which is that he's just organised the world's largest arms fair promo video that one could ever see, and it's free. He's not using advertising, he's using YouTube and social media. So, for example, on his 63rd birthday, Russian corvettes, which are ships which are cheap as chips, they're 750 tons, fired 24 cruise missiles over Iran into Syria. Well, what on earth was the point of that when he had a fleet sitting off Syria? These are, and then everything you see is being designed to show off these arms because they want to retrieve Russia's slice of the arms market in the Middle East. Of course they do. Sorry, that was a rather long answer.
Thank you, John Cuphead. I wonder if you could say a little more about the role of the Kurds.
Yes, a long time ago I wrote a history of the PKK, which really should come back into print because it's quite useful. The Kurds are for the Kurds, and I think that is the one thing you really need to know, in the sense that I think we've witnessed in the last few weeks a rather old-fashioned great game battle for influence between the Russians and the Americans, with Brett McGurk, the senior official dealing with ISIS for the State Department, visiting the Kurds in northern Syria and enraging the Turks in the process. The Russians apparently having written a bigger check and perhaps got in there sooner. To the extent that we're now witnessing Arab forces retreating from Kurdish forces who are being backed up by Russian airstrikes. This is very complicated in the sense that not only the Kurds for the Kurds, but the Kurds are for different parts of the Kurds. So you have a section of northern Syria which is being protected by Russian airstrikes, deliberately aggravating the Turks. And you have another section where the UK and others wish the Kurds to fight ISIS around Raqqa, further east. My fear, and the fear of everybody, is obviously that's been said that the Turks will respond to what's going on with more aggression than they have already. I'm actually more sympathetic to what the Turks are saying than many people are. Because I do think the Kurds are for the Kurds, and therefore if they can carve out a territorial area, much as the Iraqi Kurds did following our intervention in 1991, they will do so. I think that, to answer a point somebody made earlier about whether the Turks would invade or not, I think it's worth bearing in mind that apart from the intervention in Cyprus in 1974, the Turkish mindset, and certainly the mindset of the Turkish army, is not to cross borders. They do not wish to do that. And so what happens in the next few weeks or months, I suspect, will boil down to a battle of wills between President Erdogan, who is an unguided Islam, and his generals, who may be told to do something they don't want to do.
Can I just ask on that, is there not another complication that the British, certainly, and I think the European Union, were generally supportive of the Kurds in the last few months. The Kurds are now also fighting to help Assad. And we, the Europeans and the British, are against Assad. So we've got a rather strange triangle there. I wonder if you'd like to comment on that.
yes, there's a further point. I mean, in a way, that comes back to my word enthusiasm, because we all know who they are. They're plenty of enthusiasts for the Kurds in this country, without really realising the complexities of the Kurds. And secondly, I think that Kurdistan, like lots of other countries in the region, is suffering from low oil prices. I'm talking about the KRG and Erbil. They've got Peshmerga who've not been paid for months. They've got civil servants who are not paid. Teachers have been on strike, etc., etc. So there's a lot of problems there. And also there are a lot of Kurds in the KRG who are fed up with the corruption and nepotism of the Barzani regime in the KRG. So it's not terribly simple. And then they have extremely complicated relations, which Jonathan will know much more than I have, about with the Syrian Kurdish YPG and their aspiration to create a Rojava along the Syrian-Turkish border, which is what, of course, the Turks are going to really try and frustrate. And then, anyway, if that were to come into existence, which, of course, for the PKK would open up the second flank against the Turks on their southern border, then this gets really serious, and it also raises, why wouldn't the Kurds then bid, go, taking advantage of the general sort of disintegration of the whole region, just go for an independent Kurdistan? Although, of course, one caveat would be, and Hazir Tamurian knows this far more than I do about the Iranian Kurds, who might not be so enthusiastic for this leap into the dark.
Can I say something later on?
Spoke about the economic situation in the Kurdish north, but I just add to that, if you're looking for kind of scenarios where things could get worse, there are some. And if we look a few weeks ago, there was actually an exchange of fire between Peshmerga forces and Shia militias in Tuzhkamatu in northern Iraq. One of the key things, one of the key unresolved issues is really disputed territories and the relationship between Erbil and Baghdad. And my concern is that that's kind of, we're all fighting ISIS at the moment, we're all kind of, preoccupied with that. Once that's done, what's going to happen between Baghdad, Erbil, currently the Peshmerga occupied Kirkuk, they're pumping oil. Effectively, Baghdad, and I have sympathies with this view, says that they're stealing Northern Oil Company oil from Baghdad. That is not a sustainable situation. Something has to be done. And either can go down the diplomatic route and actually come to a settlement, or I fear there could be a further conflict further down the line between the Kurds and the Arabs.
Can I just add just one very quick point to that? And I completely agree that, that obviously when ISIS had its sudden rampage, the Kurds took the opportunity to secure Kirkuk. And we all know that some massive clash will break out over that, as you say, once ISIS is contained or away from the place. The other thing worth noting, of course, if we're thinking about Iraq, is the phenomenon of Basra regional separatism, where the people down there might think, my God, look at this up in this mess up further north. Perhaps we should try and be Kuwait Minor or Kuwait 2.0 and break away from that mess and from the chaos of Baghdad. So really, that's standing on the brink of disintegration too, I thought. Anyway.
I'm going to have to call a halt, I'm afraid, because the clock has caught up with us and we have to be out of here by 6:30. So I'm sorry, but if I ask another question, we have to have answers. I think we've had an absolutely fascinating couple of hours. We've had a number of different perspectives, which I think is, whether it's made us any wiser, we're certainly better informed than we were at the start. What struck me is we were talking about the region because that was what the subject was. But this is a problem that has much wider implications when you look at the potential involvement in Turkey, which is a member of NATO, which would then possibly even involve NATO, when you look at the whole concept of Russia becoming more involved in the region, its own internal problems leading to the interest of China in Iran in particular at the moment, and the new concept of the new Silk Road running through that. This is an area which has the potential to cause problems on a much wider scale. And maybe that's something we'll come back to and look at on another day. But can I ask you to thank this panel? Thank you.